Well, let me begin by alerting you to a couple of podcasts that you'll see at reasons.org, and or you can get it off of your iPhone. I'm just curious, how many of you have the Reasons to Believe app on your phone? Well, we go one, two, all right. Well, it's free. All you need to do is go to the App Store, and you can get the Reasons to Believe app for free. And we're actually finding out that more people are accessing our website through their phone than they are through computers. Any smartphone. Any smartphone will work. And all of our podcasts are there. Today's new Reason to Believe is there. All the events, several articles, so lots of stuff. And let me get this one turned on. Probably need to turn this one off, right? Okay, how's that? Hey, we're good. Thank you. Well, a couple of the podcasts I think I'd like you to be aware of. One actually has a Christmas connection, and it has to do with, it's been two debates I've done with Michael Shermer of the Skeptic Society, in which he tried to claim that the only accounts we have of Jesus are those in the Bible. And I said, well, what about Josephus and Tacitus? And he said, well, everybody knows those historians are not reliable. And, and he went after Josephus, trying to claim that Josephus was not a reliable because of the fact that he had made a number of mistakes. And the one that he brought out especially was the fact that Josephus said that the Second Temple was not fully completed until well after Herod the Second, Herod the Great. And I said, because we know that the temple indeed was completed by Herod the Great, that proves that Josephus is not a credible historian, and therefore everything he says about Jesus is not to be believed, and we really don't have any reliable secular historical accounts that confirm what we see in the four Gospels. And his whole point was, well, the four Gospels are written by Christians. Naturally, we're going to expect it to be biased. Well, there's a discovery that was made in Jerusalem literally just days ago that proves that Josephus was right about the temple. And what they did is they found four coins underneath the old city walls that would have been at the time of the Second Temple. And since we're underneath the Second Temple, and the other thing is that the date they had on it was 17 AD. Well, when did Herod the Great die? He died in 4 BC. So the fact that they found these coins with the date 17 AD on it tells us that those walled structures were not completed in the days of Herod the Great. They were completed well after Herod the Great. And that's exactly what Josephus said, is that Herod the Great got things started. He did most of the construction, but the construction of the Second Temple was not fully complete until a couple of generations or a generation after the death of Herod the Great. And now we got the coins to prove it. Yes?
Were they already counting time at 17 AD? Wasn't even dead yet.
Well, the coin doesn't say 17 AD on it. Rather, what you have on there is a date that's a relative to the reign of Caesar Augustus, but it translates into 17 AD because we know when all these events in the life of Caesar Augustus took place. So that's how they're able to say these coins had to be after 17 AD because they weren't minted until 17 AD, and yet they show up underneath that walled structure. Yes?
Now we have 17 outside the Bible, secular sources referencing Christ, and some even his crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, Tacitus being one of the main ones. How does he deal with Tacitus, a Roman historian and senator, and the other 16 sources?
Well, this is what happens in debates. You don't get to tell the whole story. I don't get to tell the whole story. And what he was doing is being selective. And I think the reason why he picked on Josephus is that's the one that Christians most frequently use to say that the Gospels are not alone in telling about the life of Jesus. Josephus, who is a Jewish historian who is opposed to the Christian faith, nevertheless recorded in his history of the Jews the account of Jesus, his life, and his birth, life, and crucifixion, and claimed resurrection. And just exactly what the Gospels do. And the whole point is, if a Jewish historian who's opposed to the Christian faith recorded this in the same manner the Gospels did, then this shows that the Gospels have not been corrupted. They have to be really telling about real history. And so since that's the most frequent source that Christians use to support their case, that's why Michael Shermer went after Josephus and said, this guy is not credible. He got the facts about the temple wrong. Well, now we know that he really did get them right. So he's been fully vindicated, which means that Christians are vindicated in saying that Josephus is a credible historian, and he also talks about the birth, life, death, or crucifixion, and the claimed resurrection of Jesus from the dead. So the second one was something that happened Monday morning of last week, and this is a discovery, a scientific discovery, that, I don't know, it may rank as the most widely reported discovery of 2011. We'll see. The year's not finished yet. But it was the announcement that Kepler-22b, which is a planet, is, quote, a Goldilocks planet, in that it would have a surface temperature that would be conducive for life. In fact, in the lot of the reports, it said that it would have a temperature, average temperature on the surface of the planet, is 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which is kind of where most of us set the thermostat because we want an ideal temperature. So the argument is this is a planet that really does have an ideal temperature for liquid water and hence for life. And it's the first such planet that they found that really fits into what they call the life habitable zone. Now, a couple of comments about that. And by the way, if you listen to our podcast, this is not the most important part of the discovery. The most important part of the discovery, as far as I know, did not even get a blip on any of the web articles that are there. But it is in the peer-reviewed piece that's coming out in the Astrophysical Journal. I'll get to that in a minute, but let me just first respond to, is this really a planet that's going to have an ideal temperature for liquid water on its surface? Well, the caveat is that it would be 72 degrees Fahrenheit average temperature if this planet, Kepler-22b, has an atmosphere that's identical to the atmosphere of the current planet Earth. But the astronomers who made the discovery were very quick to point out that that's almost certainly not the case. Why? Because they have a measurement of the diameter of the planet. They discovered this planet as a result of a transit. If you're not familiar with that terminology, a transit is what happens when a planet passes between our line of sight and the star. And when a planet passes between our line of sight and the star, it dims the light of the star. And so this is a satellite, the Kepler satellite that NASA put up, that actually looks at 150,000 stars and determines whether or not they're dimming and getting brighter. Now, part of the problem is a lot of stars vary in their brightness quite naturally. And therefore, the trick is to ferret out the natural light variations in a star as opposed to what happens when a planet crosses a star. Well, it's fairly easy to do if you can get several planet crossings because, you know, when a planet crosses in front of a star, it's going to do it again as it completes its orbit. And so if you can get repeated dimmings and brightenings, and by the way, when a planet goes in front of a star, it will dim the light of a star by a very predictable pattern. You'll see a slight dimming, it creeps up, goes to maximum dimness, stays there for a while, and then comes out. And if this happens three times, they count that as a discovered planet. In other words, they would need three passes in front of a star. Which is why it's taken so long for them to announce the discovery of all the planets. And really, the big news is that Kepler, this is the second data release from Kepler, and it's doubled the number of detected planets. It was about a little more than a year ago where they said, we now have 1,100 candidates. Well, the list now stands at 2,326 candidates. So with an extra year and a few more months of observations, the number of discovered planets has gone way up. In fact, the anticipation is that before the Kepler mission is finished, they may have discovered as much as 10,000 planets. And then they have plans to set up even more sensitive telescopes in space that could have the possibility of detecting 100,000 or even a million planets. But now we got double. But this particular planet, Kepler-22b, as it goes in front of its star, they know what kind of star it is, so they have a rough idea of the diameter of that star, and then they look at how it dims as it comes into the limb of the star, and that gives them a measure of the diameter of the star. And you get actually six measurements. When it comes in, you get a measurement. When it comes out, you get a measurement. And if you get three passes, that gives you a total of six measurements. Well, the bottom line is it comes in with a diameter that's 2.4 times greater than the diameter of planet Earth. And so if it's that big of a planet, almost certainly it's got a much thicker atmosphere than the Earth. Now, what they could do in the way of follow-up is actually measure the spectrum of the planet compared to the spectrum of the star, because what will happen is as it goes in front of the star, you'll see the spectral characteristics change. Why? Because now you've got a spectral contribution from the atmosphere of the star in addition to emissions from the atmosphere of the planet in addition to the atmosphere of the star. That has not been done yet, but that would actually give them some really good insight as to what the atmosphere of the planet might be. And if they can get the mass of the star, then they would have the density, and that would also tell them whether or not it's got a very thick atmosphere or not. They do not yet have a mass measurement, so that's missing. So with that, then we really know what's going on. But the fact that its diameter is 240% bigger than that of our star or our planet Earth almost certainly implies it's got a very thick atmosphere. And incidentally, planets that we've been discovering that are most Earth-like have been coming in where we do have measurements of the atmosphere. Their atmospheres have been coming in at about 1,000 times thicker than that of the Earth. And this is one of the remarkable features of planet Earth. For a planet of its size, it has an extremely thin atmosphere. And only if this planet has a very thin atmosphere like Earth would you get a temperature of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. With what we expect it to be, its temperature will be hot enough to melt lead on its surface. So this would not qualify as a planet that would have liquid water on its surface. The other thing we notice is that it orbits its star in 289 days. The star is a little bit smaller than our star, the Sun. It's about 15%, pardon me. Let me see if I can get the exact figure here on the star. I don't have it here. It's about 80 to 90% the mass of our star, the Sun. But that does mean that there's a high likelihood that this planet, Kepler-22b, is tidally locked because it's orbiting closer to the star than our star, the Sun. And we need to realize this. If our planet Earth were even slightly closer to our star, the Sun, it too would be tidally locked.
Is Venus tidally
locked? Venus is suffering the consequences of tidal locking. It's not perfectly tidally locked like the Moon is. By the way, if you're not familiar with that term, the Moon is a very good example of a tidally locked body, where it is so close to our planet Earth that the gravity of the Earth is much stronger on the near side than it is the far side. And what that does is it forces one face of the Moon to always face the Earth. So when you look at the Moon, you only see, quote, the front half part. The back half you don't see. That's because as the Moon orbits about the Earth, it rotates with the same period that it revolves, keeping the same face towards the Earth. Matter of fact, the tidal locking is so strong that the Moon's rock is 150 feet bulged towards the Earth. So it actually has solid tides on it. You know, so you know, you look on planet Earth, we get tides from the moon, but it kind of pulls the water maybe a couple of feet towards the moon. In this case, solid rock is pulled 150 feet towards the Earth. So it's a powerful tidal locking. Mercury, you can see both Mercury and Venus, evidence of the tidal locking. And, you know, it's not perfectly tidally locked, but what you notice is Venus has a very long rotation period. Instead of it being 24 hours, approximately like Earth and Mars, you get a rotation period that's actually more than a year in the case of Venus. In the case of Mercury, the rotation period is about the same as the revolutionary period. Yes?
Are you saying if we're always looking at the same side of the moon, that the moon itself does not rotate?
Oh, its rotation period is identical to the revolutionary period. So yeah, it does rotate, but it rotates at the same rate that it revolves around the Earth, which means that it always maintains just one face towards the Earth. Okay.
I don't get it.
You don't get it? Well, need a volunteer. No, I'll just use this coffee cup. This will help you see it. So, say this is the moon and I'm the Earth.
Okay.
And then we have, if it wasn't rotating, it would do this, which means I would see all the faces of the moon as it went around me. But see, what's happening is it's actually slowly rotating as it revolves around me so that it keeps the same face towards me. So that's a good way to... Glad we had a coffee cup here. So you never know when you need these things. So... we don't know for sure whether Kepler 22b is tidally locked. I'm just saying there's a good probability that it might be. But because it is such a big planet, 2.4 times the diameter of the Earth, it almost certainly is an atmosphere that's far thicker than the Earth's, and therefore its temperature would be much greater. Nevertheless, if this Kepler keeps discovering thousands of planets, it's only a matter of time before we find a planet in what's called the... a habitable zone. But I want you to recognize that the way astronomers at NASA define the habitable zone is extremely generous. Basically, what they're saying, a planet's in the habitable zone if it has the possibility of having liquid water at some place on its surface. So we're not talking about liquid water like here on planet Earth. If we have liquid water anywhere on the surface with a possibility, then it qualifies as being in the habitable zone. And what they mean by that is they also leave open what kind of atmosphere it can have. So, for example, Mars technically is in the habitable zone because if you were to put a very thick atmosphere on Mars, it would trap enough heat where the temperature at the surface of Mars would be able to sustain liquid water. Likewise, Venus is in the habitable zone because if you took all the atmosphere away from Venus, there would be no atmosphere to trap heat, and it too would have the possibility of liquid water. So in case of our solar system, we actually have three planets in the habitable zone. But now if you put a reasonable atmosphere model on any of the planets, then it turns out that none of the planets in our solar system are in the habitable zone. The only reason why our planet has liquid water on its surface is it doesn't have a reasonable atmosphere. It's got a highly unusual atmosphere, and therefore it has liquid water. In the case of Mars, its atmosphere is not thick enough to trap any significant heat. In the case of Venus, its atmosphere, being 40 times thicker than the Earth's, traps so much heat that the surface temperature is 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And incidentally, if we had a reasonable atmosphere, our atmosphere would be about 3 times thicker than that of Venus, and the surface temperature on our planet Earth likewise would be hot enough to melt lead. But because we have an atmosphere that is less than 1% of what an Earth-type planet should be able to retain, you say, where do we get these numbers? It's quite simple. The greater the gravity of the planet, the greater the atmosphere it will accumulate during its formation. The other factor is the closer it is to its star, the more heat from that star will drive off the atmosphere. And so a normal planet is one where you can quite easily calculate the expected atmosphere. It will be based on how far away it is from the star and how what the gravity on the surface of that planet would be. So if you know the mass of the planet, and if you know the radius of the planet and the distance from its star, you can calculate the atmosphere. In the case of our planet Earth, we don't have a normal atmosphere because we had three unusual events in the early history of our solar system that stripped almost all the atmosphere away from the primordial Earth. But let me get to what I think is the most exciting part of this discovery. Actually, two components. You know, Kepler has been up there long enough that we've been able to do significant follow-up research. And that's what this Kepler thing is designed to do. Not to detect planets, but to detect planet candidates. And the idea is that ground-based telescopes would follow up on these candidates and determine whether or not it actually is a real planet or a false detection. Because with ground-based telescopes, you can actually look for a Doppler effect, because as the planet is orbiting about the star, the mass of that planet will cause the star to move closer to us or farther away from us as that planet orbits about the star. And so with those follow-up measurements, we can transform the candidates into actual detected planets. And if you're not aware of this, there's a website you can go to, exoplanet.eu. It's a European website. Or just Google. Easiest way to find it is just to put into your search engine Exoplanet Encyclopedia. And it'll take you right to a French site that's maintained by the French astronomer Jean Snyder, and he actually catalogs the characteristics of all positively detected planets. Not the candidates, only those where we're certain that it actually is a planet and we got some measured characteristics of the planets. Last time I checked, which was a couple of days ago, the catalog had 708 planets outside of our solar system. But those 708, compared to the efforts to transform the Kepler candidates into actual detections, they now know that the Kepler candidates, what we're seeing so far is an 80% conversion rate. In other words, 80% of the candidates proved to be actual planets, 20% proved to be false detections. So that's how it's going so far. That number may change as research continues, but it does seem like the majority of these candidates will prove to be real planets. But one of the things that comes in the peer-reviewed paper is going to be appearing in the Astrophysical Journal, which I thought was the most important part of the discovery, is they now have some statistics on what these 2,326 planets are like, candidates. 207 are coming in at about the size of our planet Earth, and 680 are qualified as super-Earths. What's a super-Earth? That's a planet that's between 1 and 10 times the size of our planet Earth. And then 1,181 are coming in as being Neptunes. You say, what are Neptunes? Well, Neptune is 17 times the mass of the Earth. Uranus is 14 times the mass of the Earth. Astronomers call a planet a Neptune if it falls between about 10 and 30 times the mass of the Earth. And so what you notice here is that about half of all the candidates are coming in as Neptunes. And so Neptune seemed to be the predominant discovered planet in the system. How many are like the size of Jupiter and Saturn? 208. And then 55 qualify as super-Jupiters. Now, when we do the radial velocity method, most of them are coming in as Jupiters and Saturns. Well, for very good reason. They're the easiest one to detect. The bigger the mass of the planet, the more it's going to disturb the position of the star. And astronomers have known that for some time. With the transits, you actually get realistic statistics on what these extrasolar planets are looking like. But what we're seeing here is something quite different than what we see in our solar system. That what we're seeing in the extrasolar planetary systems is a severe predominance of Neptune-sized planets. And most of these Neptune-sized planets are coming in at orbiting fairly close to their stars. because they're transit detections, I mean, the closer the planet is to the star, the more likely you are to detect it. And, you know, as we've been doing follow-up research on these Neptunes, they're proving to be orbiting roughly in the neighborhood of where the Earth is. So Mars to Venus is where we're predominantly seeing these Neptunes. Some of them are hot Neptunes, which means they're orbiting around where Mercury orbits or even closer. But what it is telling us is that we're predominantly seeing in these extrasolar planetary systems are these small gas giants on the size of Uranus and Neptune, which we know can only form beyond what's called the snow line. The snow line is a technical term where you take a star and you figure out how far away you got to go from that star before water is permanently in a frozen state. That's called the snow line. And in the case of our solar system, the snow line lies between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. And only beyond the snow line can a gas giant planet form, which means a planet that would be bigger than a super Earth. Rocky planets, you can get forming in close, but you can't get gas giants forming in close. And yet we look at these extraplanetary systems, we notice they're loaded with gas giant planets that are orbiting close to the star, which means that the most common characteristic we're seeing in these extraplanetary systems are where you get all these gas giants forming far away from the star, where most of them are relatively small, like Uranus and Neptune, and then they drift in towards the star. But this is a problem for life. If you've got gas giant planets forming far away from the star and then drifting into the inner part of that planetary system, that will disturb the possibility of having a planet like Earth where life could exist, and especially advanced life could exist, because the movement of these gas giants from the outer planetary system to the inner planetary system is guaranteed to bring about significant disturbances in an orbit of a planet like Earth that's orbiting in what we would call the life habitable zone. And this seems to be the dominant feature of these extraplanetary systems. By the way, none of that got into the public articles, but it is in the peer-reviewed report. Although I did find, the NASA website actually reported the statistics. It was the one for the public web announcement of this discovery that actually got into the statistics of the planets. So if you go to the NASA website, you'll find an easy to understand. Oh, by the way, it's only about 150 words total, because a lot of these web articles went on for pages and pages about how wonderful it is that we found a planet in the life support zone. But the NASA site is only about 150 words and talks about the statistics of the planets. And that's really what should have got the attention. It didn't. Your hand went up first.
And what's the distance range that we are able to detect planets now? How far out can we detect?
It depends on the technique. I mean, the technique that's enabling us to define planets at the farthest distance is what's called microgravitational lensing. And this is where you would have a star between us and the line of sight and a background star which has planets. And the foreground star actually magnifies the light of the star and the planets behind. And that technique has successfully discovered planets as far away as the center of our galaxy. And so that's, 30,000 light years away. And the technique, using currently available technology, would be capable of finding planets in the Andromeda Galaxy. So the limit would be about 2.5 million light years. And you say, well, can we go beyond that? Well, what really makes the technique effective is if you've got a high density of stars. And that's why we look towards the center of our galaxy, because we know it's a crowded star field, which means we've got a good possibility of finding this perfect lineup. Only if you get a perfect lineup are you going to be able to image the planets that are orbiting that distant star. And so by looking at the centers of galaxies, big galaxies, but there's really only two candidates where this technique will work: our own galaxy and the Andromeda Galaxy. Now, all the rest of the galaxies in the local group are not big enough to have a dense core of stars where this technique has any chance of reasonable success. And then bigger galaxies in the Virgo cluster are simply too far away. So that's how far we can go. This particular transit technique can go out about 1,000 light years, maybe further. This particular star, Kepler-22, 600 light years away. So it shows that this technique is effective for looking at stars that are at considerable distances, as opposed to the radial velocity method where you're looking at the movement of the star. Then that's more limited to how far away you can go. On the other hand, that's not disturbing astronomers very much, because the place in our galaxy where we have the highest likelihood of planet-bearing stars are stars that are sharing the same orbit as our star, the Sun, which means that you're going to want to look fairly close by, because that's where the probabilities are the highest. But yeah, they have actually found a planet close to the center of our galaxy. Yes?
Your focus and the focus of all the research that we're hearing reported is on whether we can find planets in the Goldilocks zone and if their parameters support life. But you're on record as saying, I think, that Titan, for example, the moon of Jupiter or Saturn, is unlikely to have life, even though we believe it has a subsurface liquid water ocean.
That would be Europa. Europa is a satellite that's orbiting Jupiter.
Okay. So Europa, right?
Right.
So my question is, all of this focus we have on planets orbiting in Goldilocks zones, isn't that a little too simplistic when there's a possibility of having liquid water beyond the snow line just by virtue of orbiting a gas giant?
Yeah, Europa is a special circumstance in that you've got a tidally locked moon orbiting a very big gas giant. And it's orbiting Jupiter so closely, and Jupiter, of course, is such a massive planet that you actually get enough tidal heating to liquefy the water below the surface of Europa. Europa is 35% water. So, you know, and that's 1,000 times more water richness than planet Earth. Earth is less than 0.03% water. Europa is 35% water. I think Ganymede is 65% water. But Ganymede is far enough away from Jupiter where the tidal heating is not going to liquefy the frozen ice. But astronomers believe Europa is close enough where the tidal heating is going to be adequate to melt the interior ice. And I've written about this in our book, Origins of Life, making the point that that does not make it a candidate for life, because Europa is subject to the oxidants-oxidants paradox. And that paradox stipulates that if you have oxidants in the environment of that liquid water, that eliminates the possibility for the origin of life, because oxidants are a powerful agent that shuts down prebiotic chemistry. On the other hand, life can't survive once it is formed without oxidants. So oxidants is a critical nutrient to keep that particular cell that's alive. So that's why they call it the oxidants-oxidants paradox. A cell, you know, like a bacterium, can't survive without a supply of oxidants. But if you have oxidants in that environment, then the life can't form. And so, in one sense, finding all these moons going around these distant gas giants where you got powerful tidal locking really doesn't help much. Now, Europa was in the news recently, and my colleague Jeff Swearink did a podcast on the latest news on Europa, which was additional evidence that perhaps Europa really does have this subterranean liquid ocean. There was debate before because we weren't sure the tidal heating was adequate, and there's some evidence from surface features that it looks like there's liquid water coming up through fissures and actually causing certain features on the surface of Europa. That's still in dispute, but the evidence is stronger today than it was, say, a month ago. But it's still the problem of the oxidants-oxidants paradox.
So that's common to all the moons of gas giants?
Yeah. In other words, if you've got a frozen shell on a planet and you've got liquid water underneath, you do have the problem of the oxidants-oxidants paradox, which means the ice has got to be thin enough or unstable enough that oxidants on the surface can get into the interior. And we do know that there's a good likelihood that Europa, for example, has oxidants on the surface. The trick is getting them through the ice to the liquid water below. But this new discovery was basically saying, hey, if we've got fissures there, maybe there's a pathway for the oxidants to get down into the liquid water. But, you know, that would also be a problem for the origin of that life. And so there's two separate issues. What do you need for the origin of life, and what do you need for the survival of life? And this is the whole idea of the oxidants-oxidants paradox. You need oxidants for the survival of life, but if you've got oxidants, that makes it impossible for an origin of life to take place there. So unless God puts the life there in Europa, then that's the only way you're going to have life possibly existing in Europa, if God actually creates it there, because by naturalistic means, the presence of oxidants would make it impossible. Okay.
Yeah, one thing furthering Ross's question is whether if you're looking for a microlensing in the Andromeda galaxy, would both stars be in the Andromeda galaxy, or would the one be in ours and the distant one in there? But my question was idea of the Neptune's farming far out and drifting in. What causes them to drift in? I know tidal effects will cause them to drift out, but what causes them to drift in?
Okay, well, that's a big question, because clearly drifting hasn't happened in our solar system, but it seems to be happening predominantly in all these extraplanetary systems. And the discovery of all these Neptunes, in fact, that was in the peer-reviewed paper, the fact that they're finding so many Neptunes that are orbiting relatively close in these extraplanetary systems tells us the drifting mechanism must be very efficient and must be ubiquitous throughout our Milky Way galaxy. Now, for a couple of decades, there's been an understanding in astronomy that if you've got enough dust and planetesimals in the system, these gas giants will gravitationally interact with the dust and the planetesimals and drift inward. And with respect to our own planetary system, there was a very limited amount of inward drift. But what happened with Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune is that in the early history of our planet system, they drifted in, but only a little bit before all the planetesimals and dust were brought down to a level where that mechanism wasn't significant, and then they began to drift outward, because there's a similar mechanism which caused an outward drift. So in the case of our solar system, there was a tiny amount of inward drift, then it stopped, and then it began to drift outward. And then everything stopped once the density dropped really down.
Theoretically, this could be a larger mechanism with a dustier environment.
Yeah, you get a dustier environment with more planetesimals, and you're going to get a very strong inward drift. And this is also confirmed by the fact that we're now finding the equivalent of Oort clouds and Kuiper belts around nearby stars. And what we're seeing is that the Kuiper belts of these systems are coming in at more than 1,000 times bigger than the Kuiper belt in our solar system. Right now, the Kuiper belt, and you're not familiar with that term, that's the belt of comets and asteroids beyond the orbit of Neptune. That particular Kuiper belt is far bigger than the main belt of asteroids, which exists between Mars and Jupiter, but it's literally coming in at about 1,000 times smaller than what we see around other stars. And hey, if you've got Kuiper belts that big, then you're going to get a lot of inward drift. The other thing that's unusual about our Kuiper belt is it's distant, but it wasn't always distant. There was a time when our Kuiper belt was sitting around the orbit of Jupiter and Saturn. It got pushed outward by a 1-2 resonance event. By the way, I got four articles up on our website. You can also get it through your phone app. Four articles that describe the early history of our solar system, going into what happened to the gas giants, how they drifted in a little bit, then they drifted outward, what caused all these mechanisms, but basically making a point. We live in a unique system that had extraordinary events that were not seen duplicated in these other systems.
Okay, what about the microlensing for stars in the Andromeda galaxy?
Okay. Well, In fact, there used to be a fellow who attended this class here from Caltech, Eric Agol. He's actually part of a major microlensing research project. And you know, Eric was telling me that what they're really hoping for is where you get you know, our line of sight, a star, another star, and then a more distant system of planets on it. Because now you get a super microlensing event. And there's actually a possibility that we're going to find such things. Much more common, of course, is where you only got one star that's doing the gravitational lensing. But if you could get two, then... And that's really what you need to get decent results for Andromeda. So in the case of Andromeda, they're going to need a couple of stars that are perfectly lined up in order to get the results that we need.
Those stars would be both in the Andromeda galaxy or one in our galaxy and one...
The requirement is they must be virtually perfectly lined up. So it doesn't really matter where they are, but you need them lined up. So, and, you know, if it's too close to us, then the gravitational lensing is not the kind of lensing you're going to want. You want it to be far enough away that it's actually going to give you a decent image of the planetary system beyond. So, yeah, I think you're next, then go ahead.
Yeah, it seems to be a matter of timing too. If you know, it took us what the solar system four and a half billion years. If somebody from another planet would be looking at us, say 4 billion years back or 3.5 billion, they wouldn't see anything. I mean, they wouldn't see any life. And I would think that the same thing. We look at other planets. We look at them at different stages of their evolution. You wouldn't see anything. You would say, well, that's lifeless.
Well, we're not quite there yet, Al. I mean, there's papers that have been published saying, okay, it's one thing to find a planet that might have the possibility of liquid water. How do we know if it really has liquid water? Which means we're going to have really good spectral information on that planet. And then, you know, how do we know if there is life in that water? Well, it's been argued that maybe the best biosignature would be a lot of free oxygen in the atmosphere. I mean, we have 21% free oxygen in our atmosphere, and it's really difficult to think of any abiotic process that would pump that much oxygen in the atmosphere. And so it's been suggested, let's see if we can find any planets out there that has as much oxygen in its atmosphere as our planet Earth does.
But our planet it went through a lot of changes.
Well, I mean, bring up a good point. Even if you got the planet loaded with life for 3 billion years, that still isn't going to produce the oxygen we see in our planet, because if you just go back 250 million years ago, we only had 10% oxygen in our environment. And there are ways to get up to 10% without life. So, I mean, what you really want to do is get to that 20%, but you're bringing up a very good point. Even if the planet is loaded with life for 3.8 billion years, that's the minimum time you need to get to 20% oxygen. In fact, that's something I was going to talk to you about today when we get into our subject about you know, the anthropic principle and equality. It's very challenging to get to 21% oxygen in the atmosphere in as little time as it has happened here on planet Earth, and it's only been possible because the Creator packed the Earth with as much life as possible for as long as possible to get the oxygen up to that high as quickly as it did. But it means if you're trying to find God doing that somewhere else, you're only going to find it on a planet that's at least 4.5 billion years old. Now, they are routinely measuring the ages of the stars here. So we know from this list of 2,300-odd planets how old the stars are that these planets are orbiting. And some are older than our sun, some are younger than our sun. They're all over the map. But yeah, from the perspective of advanced life, we can cross off all the stars on the list that are too young. So, and then if they're too old, we can cross them off too, because if they're too old, the stars are going to be very unstable. And so you basically only want to look at stars that are 4.5 7 billion years old. And if you do that, then all the stars are off the list. So
looking at us, and they don't see any life, but you know, some religion on that star would say, well, look at that, we're the only ones in the whole universe.
Well, there's two factors here. What do you need to have bacteria on a planet? In which case, you've got quite a wide range of ages that are possible. So if you find a star that's only 800 million years old, hey, it could have bacteria on it. And if it's 5 billion years old, it could still have bacteria on it. But if you're talking extraterrestrial intelligent life, it can only happen on a star that's 4.5, 7 billion years old, where the star is exactly the mass of our star, the Sun, and where it has the same lithium abundance as our star, the Sun, which is something I mentioned last week. They've now, I don't know whether you've heard this. In fact, we haven't done a podcast on this yet. We're scheduled to do it next week. The Allen Array is back up and running, thanks to private donations. And so they're now going to start looking for signals from intelligent beings and other planets. But I can tell you right now, they're not going to find anything because all the stars they're looking at have the wrong age and the wrong mass.
But you're saying so, everything has to be just like our formation of life on the planet. And all these other planets, it doesn't have to be perfectly like ours, does it? I mean, can't there be other...
If you're talking civilizations that are capable of communicating across interstellar space, they have to be virtually identical to us.
Perfectly like us.
I mean, the only presumption I'm bringing here is that it's carbon-based life. We know boron doesn't work. We know silicon doesn't work. You've got to go with carbon. And if you're going with carbon, it demands these extreme fine-tuning characteristics, which means that every star that the Allen Array is looking at, we already know is a non-candidate for intelligent life. So, by the way, I'm all in favor of using the Allen Array for astronomy, just not for looking for extraterrestrial intelligent signals. Not in least
toward Washington, and they didn't find any intelligent.
Well, yeah, that joke has been made as far back as the days of Senator Proxmire.
Yeah.
He said, "I don't want to fund this until they find intelligent life in Washington. Then I'll be able to fund it." Hey, you know what? I'm going to ask that you give me the last 15 minutes of this class because I've been struggling to get through this anthropic principle and equality. We're going to actually do it today. So let me jump into this. And a very quick introduction here, then we'll move on. The anthropic principle and equality is based on astronomers' deductions that you can't bring life into existence anywhere in the universe in less than 14 billion years approximately. And that's just because of the physics of the universe. If you've got gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, it's going to take that amount of time minimum. On the other hand, it was Frank Tipler and John Barrow, a couple of physicists, who took the results from the British cosmologist Brandon Carter and said, in that universe, you can't have advanced life existing for any longer than 41,000 years. And actually, it could be briefer than that. Keep in mind, though, we're talking about cooperative civilization. The definition there is where you've got advanced life, where those life forms are living in villages, where they're specializing in different activities and trading with one another. Although humans have been around for 50 to 100,000 years, we've only had that level of cooperative civilization for the past 11,000 years. And it was a couple of months ago I made the point that one of the reasons why you need those 14 billion years is because of the abundance of uranium and thorium doesn't reach a peak until the universe is slightly more than 9 billion years. And uranium and thorium are critical to make a planet that's got continents and oceans on it and a strong, steady magnetic field, which means you're going to want your planet to form when the universe is slightly more than 9 billion years old. If it forms earlier than that or later than that, then you won't have adequate uranium and thorium. Now, you don't want to have advanced life right at 9.2 billion years because when the Earth was formed, it had the maximum abundance of uranium and thorium. Those are radiometric elements, and it's those elements, the heat from which drives the plate tectonics and sets up the dynamo in the core of the Earth to drive the magnetic field. But early in the history of the Earth, there was so much uranium and thorium around that it was producing natural nuclear reactors. And so here's one that we know of in Okla, Gabon, where 2 billion years ago, this was an active natural nuclear reactor. Now, We still have lots of uranium-238 around, which is a primary heat source for the plate tectonics and the magnetic field, but 2 billion years ago, there was lots of uranium-235. And that's the stuff we use to make atomic bombs. It will set off a chain reaction. Uranium-238 won't, but uranium-235 will. So you're going to want to wait long enough where most of the uranium-235 is decayed away. And that's the situation we have today. There are no natural nuclear reactors running on planet Earth because there's not enough uranium-235 to support those natural nuclear reactors. And that's okay for a bacterium. They can handle the radiation. Advanced life can't. And another reason why you want to wait an extra 4.5 billion years beyond the point where the Earth forms is because of the variation in the solar luminosity. There's a particular luminosity that's needed for advanced life. That occurred 3 times in the history of the sun. But notice the first 2 times it occurred was when the luminosity was changing at a very rapid rate. You want to have advanced life where the luminosity is changing slowly, which is the case today. So back here, you have it changing very rapidly. Also here, but here you have it changing slowly. So you're going to want to wait those 4.57 billion years after 9.2, put it together. That explains why we live in a universe that's 13.75 billion years old. Another reason why you want to wait an extra 4.5 billion years is because the sun is quite unstable when it's young and will become much more unstable when it's old. It's maximally stable when it's virtually perfectly middle-aged. And by the way, I forgot to tell you this last week. People were asking me, well, what kind of scale are we dealing with here? This scale is logarithmic. It's not a linear scale, which means that as I go up a little bit here, that's like a factor of 10, another factor of 10, another factor of 10. So we're really talking dramatically greater solar flaring when the sun is only a couple of billion years old, and that will, again, repeat as the sun becomes 5, 6, and 7 billion years old. And just to give a quick summary here, we are orbiting a star which has the optimal luminosity stability and the minimum amount of flaring activity. Stars that are smaller than the sun will have more flaring activity. By the way, that's a factor in the discovery of all these planets by the Kepler mission. Most of the planets they're finding are orbiting stars a lot smaller than the sun. And those are stars where the flaring activity is going to be far more serious than it is in our star, the sun. So that's why you really have to go with a star that's virtually identical to the mass of the sun, because stars that are bigger and stars that are smaller are more unstable. And in the case of the sun, we hit that maximum stability when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. But because of neutrino measurements, we know the sun entered an exceptionally stable luminosity phase beginning 50,000 years ago, and we know that can last for only a maximum another 50,000 years. So that kind of gives you right away a rationale for why this inequality is real. There's only a 100,000-year window based on just the physics of the sun alone in which human civilization can flourish. But it takes 13.75 billion years to reach that maximum stability. And then also we need to appreciate that when the Earth begins, there are no continents. You have to wait a significant period of time before plate tectonic activity builds up sufficient continental landmass coverage of the surface of the Earth. And for advanced life, you really want it to be at about a 29% coverage rate of the surface of the planet. That's where we are right now. As we move into the future, it's going to become 30%, then 31%, and then we'll have too much continental landmass coverage. And you say, why does it have to be right at that 29%? That's when you get the best recycling of nutrients, which means that's going to be a period of time when the planet will be able to support the greatest biomass and the greatest biodiversity. And also, we need to recognize that we're living on a planet where the continents are separated by the right distances and they're oriented the right way. So as you look at a globe, you'll notice that the continents are separated by 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,000 miles from one another, and the continents are essentially oriented north-south. And what that means is that's you're going to get the most favorable ocean current set up, which is going to lead to the maximum oxygenation of the planets, which is going to enable the maximum amount of marine life to exist in the oceans at all different depths. It's also going to produce the best possible climate on the continental land masses. So what we've been enjoying these past few thousand years, for example, as really the optimal climate conditions that our planet has ever manifested. And as I mentioned last week, we're also living at the ideal time in the ice age cycle of planet Earth. For the past 7 million years, what we've been seeing on our planet is a cycle of 90,000 years of an ice age followed by a 10,000-year warm interglacial. And if you're talking global high technology, human civilization with a reasonably large human population, you don't want to be in the middle of an ice age. You want to be in one of those interglacials. And you want to be at the right time in the interglacial where you've got the best ocean current set up so as to keep that maximum oxygenation and the best possible climate for the continental land masses. That's only been the case, for about the past 10,000, 15,000 years. And so it shows us that the window, rather than being, say, 41,000 years wide, as John Barrow and Frank Tipper calculated, it looks like it's only about 15,000 years wide. And you say, well, couldn't we extend that a little bit more? Maybe we could, but not a lot. I mean, it's only a matter of time before we move into the next ice age. And actually, I think what's fascinating is the speeding up of global warming may actually hasten the onset of the next ice age because of the way it would disturb the currents running in the Atlantic and the Pacific. Now, let me get to the atmospheric oxygen, because this is a point that came up. You know, for a planet to have advanced life, it's got to have a lot of oxygen. In fact, that's one thing I've been sharing with my friends who are involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. Number one, make sure you got the right star before you bother to look. And number two, before you bother to look, let's make sure the planet orbiting that star has got the right oxygen. Because unless you've got 20% oxygen or thereabouts, it's not going to be a planet capable of supporting intelligent life. And the case of planet Earth, it did start off with a small amount of oxygen. And so our planet has always had oxygen in its environment. And this is the discovery. By the way, another advertisement for getting our phone app is you'll find a podcast there by Buzz Rana, where he talks about a discovery in zircons which shows us that before the origin of life on planet Earth, there was sufficient oxygen in the Earth's environment to be an impediment for the origin of life. And so we purposely titled our book Origins of Life because at that time, 2004, it was still an open question. Did God create little episodes of life before 3.83 billion years ago? Or was it not until sometime later? Well, it now seems like at no point in Earth's history was there sufficient lack of oxygen that prebiotic chemistry could run. It's always had enough oxygen to stop prebiotic chemistry. So now we can conclude that at any time in Earth's history, if you want life on the planet, you're going to need supernatural intervention. It's not going to happen by naturalistic means. But what this curve is showing you here is just how difficult it is to get oxygen up to the level that you need. And actually, if you pack the planet with photosynthetic life, it can oxygenate the planet quite quickly. But the problem is our planet Earth is filled with these gigantic oxygen sinks. The mantle of the Earth, for example, is a huge oxygen sink. And so you're not going to get enough oxygen in the atmosphere until you oxidize the mantle, oxidize the crust, and then you can begin to build up oxygen in the atmosphere. And so throughout the entire past 3.83 billion years, we have photosynthetic life on the planet aggressively pumping oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, but it doesn't really do much until literally the last half billion years where we see that sharp rise up. That's this part here is literally the last 250 million years. So the Cambrian explosion's about here. This is the Permian Triassic extinction event. and thereafter the oxygen content goes up. The reason why it goes up so fast, by this time the oxygen sinks and the core and the mantle of the Earth have been filled, and therefore photosynthetic life can pump it up to the 20-21% level it's necessary for advanced life. But there again, this plays into the anthropic principle inequality. You literally have to wait those extra 4.5 billion years for it to happen. And once again, I want to emphasize, it takes very aggressive creation activity to get the oxygen content up to 21% as rapidly as only 4.5662 billion years. We would anticipate that it would take a lot longer, but because of what we see in Psalm 104, how God is aggressively creating life on planet Earth, that we get the oxygen content up as rapidly as we do. And then there's also this factor, that if you want advanced life, you're probably going to need some fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas. And this is just a graph for petroleum. I could produce a similar one for coal and natural gas, but it makes the point that there is a time when the mineable petroleum reaches a maximum amount. And you say, well, how come we can't get a lot of petroleum earlier? It takes the Avalon explosion animals and the Cambrian explosion animals to provide the raw resources for the fossils of those animals, the remains of those animals to be transformed into petroleum. And so what you, and so as that life is created and as it gets buried, it can get converted into petroleum. Certain geological processes must be in place to make that petroleum. You say, well, why would it decline after a period of time? Well, there are bacteria that work to degrade petroleum into natural gas. And so, yeah, when you find a place that's got these biodeposits, typically what you see is a pocket of natural gas, and underlying it you've got petroleum. But if you wait too long, then all the petroleum gets converted into natural gas. All you've got is a natural gas. And you really want to be living on a planet that's got lots of coal, lots of petroleum, and lots of natural gas. But this is just the curve you get for petroleum, similar curves you can get for coal and natural gas. Now, of course, today with our technology, we could say it's possible we could get the energy we need without these fossil fuels. A lot of people are saying, let's, you know, do what we can to wean ourselves off fossil fuels and go for other sources of energy where we don't have to burn stuff. The problem is you're probably not going to get that technology unless you first have an initial technology that is dependent on fossil fuel production. Today we can think about getting sources of energy that are not dependent upon fossil fuels. 300 years ago, that would not be within the realm of possibility. The technology didn't exist, and it took mineable petroleum, for example, to advance our technology to a point where we wouldn't be dependent upon petroleum. Kind of, we talked about in the book of Job, we need certain animals to launch civilization. They're not so critical today, but they were very critical in the past, and we wouldn't get where we are today without those animals. Likewise, we couldn't even think about nuclear fission or nuclear fusion if we didn't have the fossil fuels that got our technology up to where it is today. Now, we could make also similar curves for other resources, you know, things like potash, which basically is a biodeposit. You get potash from the, from birds defecating on certain islands. And isn't it interesting that God created birds that like to congregate on these little small islands? And they congregate there in the millions, and they leave a nice potash reserve behind for us to be able to take advantage of. And likewise, we could develop curves for certain concentrated metal ores. Ores are concentrated predominantly by sulfate-reducing bacteria, gypsum. So in other words, we're actually living at the ideal concrete moment, where we have biodeposits which enable us to exploit the crust of the Earth to relatively easily develop concrete. So, yeah, when we celebrated Thanksgiving, we thank God for the fact that we live at the ideal concrete moment so that our relatives could actually drive on freeways and spend Thanksgiving with us. So, but the bottom line is this. There really is this anthropic principle inequality. where you have this very narrow window of time in which any kind of advanced civilization is possible, and it does take virtually 14 billion years to get there. So I see I'm out of time. What I'm going to do next week when we talk about this is draw the philosophical significance of this anthropic principle and equality. Now, if you read the physicists that have developed this equality, they have come up with the philosophical implications. And basically they're saying there's got to be somebody out there who has a very high value. And some of them say there's got to be something out there. They're not willing to call it a person, but they're saying there's something out there that must really value human beings and have a very high purpose for human beings to explain this particular inequality. I was at a wedding yesterday, so next week I'm going to give you what I call the wedding ceremony analogy for what this is all about. But there are other analogies we can develop as well. So you can think of some of your own between now and next week. So, but the bottom line is the fact that it takes so much time to get us where we are and so little time that we can live in a civilized state once we reach that time has very significant theological and philosophical implications. So we'll get to that next week, and then we'll move on into our subject of human origins. Actually get into a lot of the debates that are taking place on the forefront of theistic evolution and where the research is going to go in the next few years, contrasted with what the Bible says about Adam and Eve and our inheritance of sin from Adam and Eve and all the other issues. What's wonderful about human origins is the science of human origins really ties in very significantly to the whole subject of sin, original sin, salvation from sin. And so this is a really key area that's being widely debated in such magazines as Christianity Today and the World Magazine, as well as the scientific literature, just about, you know, here's a place where the two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture, are really coming together, some would say clashing with one another, but we'll get into this and see how we can integrate the two books and draw some conclusions. So with that, let me bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this wonderful time in which you've chosen for all of us to live. Thank you for creating us, causing us to be born in the time and place that you did cause us to be born. And Father, I pray, as David prayed, that he would realize that the date he was born and the location he was born was not an accident. It was all under your control. And help us, Father, to discern in the case of each one of us as individuals why you chose the time that we were born, the place that we were born, and the development of our life from the time we were born to the time we become adults. Lord, that we may discover not only the purpose for humanity as a whole, but our individual purpose in preparing us for life in the new creation. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Remember the Skeptics Forum literature?
I got these yesterday.